From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Gary Wills has taken a break from writing about presidents to write about John Wayne, whose image of masculinity and patriotism has influenced American presidents. Wills' new book is about John Wayne and the politics of celebrity. Also, we talk with critic John Leonard about what he's been watching on television. He says, despite its problems, TV is full of surprising gravity and grace. And book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us about J.D. Salinger's last known story, which is about to be published in book form. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bob Whitten. President Clinton today banned the use of federal funds for human cloning research as the government rushed to catch up with recent scientific breakthroughs.
Science often moves faster than our ability to understand its implications. That is why we have a responsibility to move with caution and care, to harness the powerful forces of science and technology so that we can reap the benefit while minimizing the potential danger.
In addition to the ban on use of federal funds, the president asked that researchers observe a voluntary moratorium on human cloning experiments until legal and ethical issues can be resolved. After his comments at the White House, the president left for a personal tour of flood damage in his home state of Arkansas. Close to 50 people have been killed in flooding, tornadoes, and heavy rain that has swept through the middle part of the nation over the past week. Hutu refugees caught in Zaire's civil war have divided, with some heading deeper into government-held territory and others heading back toward Rwanda. At least 150,000 refugees fled their camp a few days ago when the war's front line arrived there. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Yesterday, a Zairean army helicopter found hundreds of exhausted refugees trudging toward Kisangani, Zaire's third-largest city and the regional base for Zaire's army. Many have been fleeing a step ahead of the rebel advance for months now. Zairean authorities expect thousands more are following. The scene is similar about 50 miles east, according to the Associated Press. Hundreds of tired families are on the road, but these are starting a 200-mile trek back toward Rwanda. They have stopped running. Zaire's refugees are mainly Rwandan Hutus who did not join in the mass return to Rwanda 4 months ago. It's thought many took part in the genocide there and have more to fear. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is raising anew the idea of sending an international force to aid the refugees, but many nations are hesitant to step into Zaire's turmoil. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
Are you one of the 60 million Americans on Social Security? Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan thinks you are getting too much in your paychecks. In testimony today before the House Budget Committee, Greenspan said the Consumer Price Index is flawed and needs to be corrected in order to truly reflect increases in the cost of living. Senate hearings on President Clinton's Labor Secretary nominee open 2 weeks from today. Vermont Senator James Jeffords scheduled the hearings for Alexis Herman, while fellow Republicans examine whether she got too mixed up in politics while director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.05 at 6920.07 in heavy trading of 240 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index at this hour is up 6.81 at 1317.99. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, U.S. stocks have pulled out of an early decline. Gains so far this session have been modest. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports.
Stocks had moved lower early in the session. Investors were concerned about a stronger-than-expected jump in new home sales in January. The report suggests that the economy may be growing fast enough to spur inflation and cause policymakers at the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. However, comments by Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan put a limit to the early decline in stocks and Treasury bond prices. He sees a continuation in stable economic growth. The Dow Industrials had dropped by more than 18 points, tame compared to yesterday morning's 50-point drop, before slowly inching back toward the positive side. Pacing the advance, shares of Exxon and Procter & Gamble, and offsetting those gains, weakness in shares of IBM. Among the most actives in NASDAQ trading, Intel tops the list, along with Ascend Communications. This is Paul Lynn.
Again, the Dow close to noon Eastern time is up 1.05 at 69.20. Conrail talks with CSX have been revived. The new round of merger talks comes after CSX matched the bid of rival Norfolk Southern Railroad of $10.5 billion. CSX and Norfolk Southern are also talking about sharing Conrail. Here's a whole new meaning for Fat City. The Coalition for Excess Weight Risk Education has ranked U.S. cities by percentage of overweight residents. Weighing in as the heaviest, the home of Fat Tuesday, New Orleans, where 38% of residents are overweight. The rest of the top five? Norfolk, San Antonio, Kansas City, Missouri, and Cleveland. Of the 33 cities rated, Denver turns out to be the leanest, with just 22% of residents on the high side of the scales. I'm Bob Witten, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We expect Gary Wills to write about presidents. He is, after all, the author of books about Lincoln, Reagan, Nixon, and Kennedy. But his new book is a biography of John Wayne. There is a connection between Wayne and the presidents Wills has studied. Nixon used Wayne's movie Chisholm to explain his own views on law and order. And Wayne was a favorite of Ronald Reagan during his career as an actor and president. Wills' new book, John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity, isn't a conventional biography. It's more concerned with the image Wayne projected and the images projected onto him.
Here's a fellow who is appealed to by acting politicians, whether Gingrich or Reagan or Nixon or Kissinger, to explain their own values. And you ask them what they believe in, not simply in terms of what policy they're going to vote for today. They turn to Wayne and say, I believe in the Duke. And so I thought, this is a fellow who transcends the normal showbiz personality, obviously, and stands on the one hand with mythical figures and on the other hand with living political figures.
You point out that both Reagan and Wayne were from Iowa, but Wayne wanted to forget that, whereas Reagan mythologized it.
Yes, it's fascinating the difference between the two. Here you have Wayne, a movie figure who became politically important, and Reagan, a politician as he ended up, who had been in movies. But they're quite different men. Their whole body language was different. Reagan was avuncular, our older brother, accommodating, very friendly, whereas Reagan was. But Wayne was very tough and the strong, demanding, paternal. And Ronald Reagan, of course, was a great Wayne fan and wanted to be Wayne. He left the studio and made himself an independent agent so he could put himself in Westerns, where he was never very good. But the only reason for that, as he said, was that John Wayne had ridden ahead with the cavalry banner.
You mentioned Newt Gingrich, too, is a big admirer of John Wayne. How does Wayne figure into the Newt mythology?
Well, his stepfather says that Newt saw Sands of Iwo Jima three times in one day when he was a boy, and that he tried to walk like Wayne and talk like Wayne. And when Elizabeth Drew went to talk to Gingrich during the time when he shut down the government, she said, your own troops, your Republican supporters, are beginning to rebel. They're saying that the public is losing patience, we've gone too far. And he told Elizabeth Drew, I learned from Sergeant Stryker, Wayne's character in Sands of Iwo Jima, that you have to be tough on your own men for their own good. And he said that Sands of Iwo Jima was the formative movie in his life.
You write in your book that you're not writing a biography of John Wayne. You want to write basically about what John Wayne has symbolized, but you say in terms of his own life, he had no interesting ideas. Do you think he was a shallow man?
Well, I think he was not interested in politics as a subject to debate or consider. He had a political stance. He was not shallow in the sense that he was a hard-working professional who understood his business, and that was his main concern, and who cooperated with a number of creative people, writers and directors, publicists, to work on this mythic figure that he became. And he was careful not to destroy that image. He didn't want to do anything that would hurt it. Once he saw that it was the source of his appeal and of his resonance with the larger community, he was told, directors, for instance, Howard Hawks said, show fear in Red River. And he said, no, I won't do that. He said, I'll show concern. I'll show worry. I won't show fear. John Wayne doesn't show fear. And in The Shootist, Don Siegel said that he should shoot somebody in the back who's just shot him. And he said, no, John Wayne doesn't shoot people in the back. So he had thought very carefully about the things that were important to him.
The director, Raoul Walsh, is the person who changed John Wayne's name from his birth name, which was Marion Morrison. For which film did Raoul Walsh do this? And did he also change the biography of John Wayne when he changed the name?
Yes, The Big Trail. Walsh found Wayne a property mover at the studio. He had done some bit acting, but he had not really acted in anything that mattered. And taking a huge chance, he took this man who had really no experience to count and decided that he moved so well that he needed him. So he renamed him, he taught him to ride, changed his appearance, had his hair grow long, put him in very tight-fitting buckskins. So he created the first John Wayne, who's kind of naive at the social level, but very much attuned to nature and the Indians, who loves to live outdoors and stay away from civilization. And that figure Wayne lived with for 10 years or so, until actually a little longer, until Howard Hawks changed him in Red River.
How did Howard Hawks change him in Red River?
Well, he changed him into the older figure. Wayne had actually been playing a man in his 20s when he was in his 30s, and now late in his 30s, Hawks said, play a man in your 40s so we can have this younger person look up to you. Montgomery Clift. And Wayne was a little reluctant, as all actors are. They hate to admit their age and certainly to exaggerate their age. But it turned out to be a brilliant thing for Wayne, because once he was established in that role, he played it for all the cavalry pictures with Ford, and it allowed him to go on much longer than most actors, because he was no longer the person having to carry the love interest with a young, beautiful woman. He was this older father figure to whom the real love interest looked up.
I know one of your favorites of John Wayne's movies is The Searchers, directed by John Ford. And I really love this film, too. And I think an interesting thing about this movie in terms of John Wayne's image is that he spends the movie in pursuit of a relation of his, a white girl who's been kidnapped by the Indians, who was kidnapped years ago. And you know, he's obsessively pursuing her. At the end, after he restores her to her family, I think it's like the final shot, a very kind of famous shot, now when the door closes on his face. You know, the family's gathered, united again, and the door's closed on him, and he's like standing outside.
Yes, he's sealed out.
Yeah, which is such an interesting thing, considering how many, quote, like family values people have used John Wayne as their hero. And he's never a family man in movies. I mean, he might have a community, but the community is more likely to be the cavalry than a wife and children.
That's right. He's normally lost his wife in one way or another. She's died, or at the beginning of Red River, she's killed by the Indians, his fiancée is. In Rio Grande, she's left him. In Sands of Iwo Jima, she's left him. Sometimes his very professionalism has made the wife say, I can't put up with your being more a Marine or more a cavalry officer than a husband, not staying at home with the children, etc. So what he does is pick up these surrogate sons because he's lost his own son. And, of course, that's true of The Searcher, where he has the young boy who's after the Indian girl. But he's the outsider who has to take care of the community. That's often the picture. In Stagecoach, he's the prisoner who's manacled and crammed inside the stagecoach. But when the Indians attack, he climbs up on top of the stagecoach and swivels in all directions and protects the people inside. He's the outsider who protects the community inside.
My guest is Gary Wills, and after writing about presidents like Lincoln, Nixon, and Reagan, he's now written a book about John Wayne called John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
¶¶
Back with Gary Wills, and we're talking about his new book, which is called John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. You say it was 1948 that John Wayne became a superstar, which is also the year he became a political activist. Doing what?
Well, he joined the Motion Picture Alliance for American Values that his friend Warren Bond had been part of. That was a group that was formed against the Hollywood establishment during the early days of congressional attempts to investigate communism in Washington. And in those early days, the industry as a whole, the guilds, the producers, the studio executives, all opposed any interference. They said, we're anti-communist, but we can handle our own. We will make sure there's no communist propaganda going out. Well, when the Cold War heated up after 1946-47, and the Hollywood Ten was indicted, people who were suspected of having been communists, and taken to Washington at a very dramatic public hearing, the studios did a complete about-face. They decided now it was much too dangerous to say, no, we won't cooperate with Congress. And they said, yes, we will cooperate. Well, during all that earlier time, Wayne had not done anything. But as soon as the studios made it safe for everybody now to say, yes, we're going to cooperate with Congress, then he became the president of the Motion Picture Guild, and he took credit for kicking people out of the country, as he put it. It's a funny thing. He said, we never blacklisted anybody. We just ran them out of the country, which seems like people would prefer to be blacklisted.
Was it during the period that he headed the Motion Picture Alliance that he was also specializing in World War II movies?
Well, 1949 is the great Sands of Iwo Jima, where he makes the most important World War II movie. So, that was the time when he was at the head of the anti-communist. And that really is a movie supposedly about World War II, but it's a Cold War movie.
In what respect?
Well, in the movies that were made about World War II in 48, 49, 50, you never really saw the enemy. The Japanese were not targets of hate or anything of that sort. What it was about was the fear and danger of men cracking, the tensions within the unit, and keeping up your nerve and retaining your discipline, which of course was much more the Cold War atmosphere of the time than the tremendous patriotic fervor and phobia about the enemies in the actual war films in the early 40s.
Run down just a list of some of John Wayne's better-known war movies.
Well, there aren't that many. Of course, there's Green Berets at the end, but during the war itself, he didn't make any tremendously important war movies. He made The Fighting Seabees, where he had a small role and lost the woman. He made films in which he doesn't show up for 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 30 minutes. He was not a big star then. Later on, at one point, he said that he stayed out of the Army because he could do more for the war effort by making these war movies. He was confusing at the time when he could make very influential war movies like Sands of Iwo Jima with what he actually did during the war. Humphrey Bogart made many more important war movies than Ronald Reagan did, than John Wayne did.
So what did he do during the war and why didn't he fight in it?
Well, he had made Stagecoach in 1939 after 10 years of making B-movies. And he wanted to get out of B-movies, and he wanted to get out of Westerns, and he thought that his career was just opening up, and he didn't want to leave. And, of course, Ronald Reagan was in exactly that same situation. He had made King's Row after a series of B-movies. And so his career was opening up, and he didn't want to leave, but he did. He didn't go overseas because he was practically blind, but he was afraid that it would hurt his career to go into the military, and it did. His image was of the boy, friendly, best friend type, and he had aged beyond that by the end of the war. So he did sacrifice. And big stars who could have made a convincing plea that they were needed at home to make pictures, Jimmy Stewart, Clark Gable, people like that, did go into the military. But Wayne did not want to. And when you go and look at the correspondence that he had with John Ford, who was very gung-ho, very militaristic, serving in OSS and trying to get all his friends into the military, you see him write letters like, oh, I'm coming in after the next movie. And then he'll write and say, I have the papers, but I'm on location and I don't have a typewriter. or he says, I went off and left the papers with Ward Bond, and he can't get Josie, his first wife, from whom he was being separated then, to give necessary documents, as if the military was really going to make it hard for John Wayne to get into the army. After he had made these various appeals and had been listed less than 1A, the draft board did list him 1A later in the war, and the studio begged for him to stay, and he was allowed to. Of course, Clark Gable could have made the same plea, but didn't. So it was entire careerism. He thought that his career was ready to take off, and he wasn't going to take a chance on coming back 5 years and seeing a whole wave of new young guys had come up, which, by the way, had happened. He didn't realize, of course, he'd be most appealing in his middle age persona.
One of John Wayne's war movies was The Green Berets, about the Vietnam War, based on a book by Robin Moore that I was surprised to find out the Defense Department really hated.
Yes.
You know, this was like the big patriotic, you know, the Vietnam War is good movie, you know, an answer to all the critics. And so why did the Defense Department hate the book that the movie was based on?
Well, if you read the book, you're not surprised. It's really a collection of short stories, and it's about soldiers of fortune, a lot of them foreigners, not American, who are in the CIA for the fun of it and who love the perks of war, the sexual perks and torture and things that, of course, we were denying that we liked and that we were engaged in. So they wanted all of that removed, and, of course, most of it is in the movie. But they were very frightened of what could be made of that book.
Because the characters in it were depicted as very kind of sadistic, racist.
Yeah, and it was, yes, and it was contemptuous of the Vietnamese. It showed these soldiers of fortune kind of laughing at the people they were supposed to be helping.
My guess is Gary Wills, and after having written extensively about such presidents as Lincoln, Nixon, and Reagan, he's written a new book about John Wayne called John Wayne's America. I'm interested in talking to you a little bit about what's happening in the White House now, some of the controversy surrounding President Clinton. Let's look at, some of the fundraising controversy, particularly what's surrounding the use of the Lincoln bedroom. Who has been a guest there during the Clinton administration? People are saying now that a lot of guests basically bought their way into the Lincoln bedroom. It was a favor in return for donating a lot of money. And I wonder what you think of this controversy.
Well, you know, if the law says you can't solicit on the federal property, and they did, then they broke the law. That's one thing. The idea that you don't give favors to people who give money to you is certainly something no politician I know of should be surprised at. Now, the need to go out and collect these vast amounts of money is obscene, and something should be done to stop that. The president himself said that he didn't have time for anything else but to drum up money. That's wrong. But we're not going to stop that by saying there's something sacred about the Lincoln bedroom and forget the rest of the influx of money. I'm fascinated by the people who say, the White House has never been used for such crass things. How short people's memories are. You know, Ollie North took group after group after group into the White House for briefings and high-level contacts to drum up money for the Contras, which was illegal money, secret money. It went into banks abroad. The White House was used for that. You know, it's not something whose sacredness has never been tainted before. On Capitol Hill, lobbyists not only were invited in for special treatment after they had given money and were obviously in line to give money, they sat down and wrote the bills. Nobody is saying that Chinese people came into the White House and sat down and wrote the policy out for the president to carry down to the Hill. I think we've gone completely overboard on this whole sacredness of the White House business, especially the Lincoln bedroom. You know, they talk about that as if it's okay if you sleep in another room, you know, and if you just bunked out in the laundry room, that would be okay. But the Lincoln bedroom. Well, you know, Lincoln never slept there. And since the whole house was gutted when Harry Truman was president, You know, you have these wonderful pictures where it's just a shell. There's nothing. There's no room. There's no floors. That whole room was created in the 40s. So Lincoln never was in there, never set foot in it, didn't lie in it. You know, the whole mystique and the idea that there's some sacrilege involved in letting people stay in the Lincoln bedroom is just silly.
If you were to try to get at what's really wrong with political fundraising, where would you look?
Well, Dick Morris is our clue. He went to Clinton and he said, they ran Harry and Louise ads and killed you on health care. You've got to fight back the way they do, with polls that tell you how to target your ads and then ads for legislative purpose, not just for campaigning. And Clinton bought that. Once you buy that, you are involved in continual polling and continual advertising of the most expensive sort.
I think you're describing quite a paradox here, that in order to, you know, pass the legislation that you want to, you spend all this money on ads, and of course spending the money on ads means raising more money, which gets you more beholden to other people.
Absolutely.
So the more you try to put across your agenda with money, the more beholden you become to other people's agendas.
Exactly. You've got it.
Gary Wills, he's the author of the new book, John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Leonard on Watching Television, reviewing books, and burning down his bedroom long before Beavis and Butthead. Leonard is TV critic for CBS Sunday Morning and author of a new book about television. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan looks at the resurrection of J.D. Salinger's most heartbreaking character.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people think that television is ruining our values and our children's values, but not TV critic John Leonard. He says we'd actually be a kinder, gentler nation if we embraced the scruples and imitated the behaviors recommended by most entertainment programs. John Leonard has a new book called Smoke and Mirrors: Violence, Television, and Other American Cultures. He's TV critic for CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine. He loves TV, but he's also devoted much of his life to books. He's former editor of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, current literary editor of The Nation, and former book critic for Fresh Air. I asked him what his current favorite programs are.
Well, the programs that I watch as a civilian include Homicide, which I make sure to watch every Friday night. I think the acting and the writing and the cinematography is fabulous, and it's like reading a very good short story every week. I will be watching. I've watched the first 10 hours of Easy Streets, which has begun a spring run that none of us knows how long it will last on CBS. Is on 10 o'clock on Wednesday nights. And Paul Haggis, who did this Due South program, wonderful program about a Canadian Mountie who comes to Chicago, has now done this sort of ghetto urban wasteland program where everybody is suspect and everybody is corrupt, and it's wonderfully written and wonderfully acted. So that I've watched the first 10 hours of, and I recommend it to everyone. It's those 10 o'clock shows that I tend to point toward because of the writers especially. I mean, David Kelly writing for Chicago Hope on Monday nights, and all the guys who write the Law and Order scripts, which are really tight and complicated and put a reverse spin on things. These are my enjoyments that I watch for strictly entertainment value. Otherwise, it's basketball.
You probably watch more TV than a lot of the people listening to us now watch. I wonder how much television you think is violent or has a lot of sexual innuendo in it, the kind of thing that might make a lot of parents uncomfortable if they knew their children were watching it.
Yeah, well, it depends on what concerns you. I think that I'm tired, but then, you know, but then I am approaching my 58th birthday. I'm fatigued at the sexual innuendo in situation comedies. At 8 o'clock, at 8:30, I don't want to stamp it out. I just find it tiresome. I find it juvenile. I find even situation comedies that I respect, like Mad About You and Seinfeld, you know, devote whole episodes to variations on a theme of penis. And I say, Jesus, it's junior high school. Who needs this? I think on network television, there's a lot more sexual innuendo. And I stress this, network primetime television, there's a lot more sexual innuendo than there is the kind of violence that frightens so many other people. You know, the right wing in this country seems to be much more worried about sex, and the left wing much more worried about violence. Most of the violence is either in syndication or most graphically on cable television, and usually pay cable television, where you have to pay a premium, so it's probably not the children of the poor that are doing all of that watching. That's where you see the graphic stuff, and it was made for the big screen Hollywood and then shows up in our living room.
You point out that a lot of cable is, as you put it, wholesome to the verge of stupefaction. Mm-hmm. Disney, Discovery, Learning, mm-hmm. Family, History, Nashville, Nickelodeon mm-hmm. channels.
If you actually channel surf, what you get is so much family, so many horses, so many crazy archaeologists in the sun-stunned, goat-munched desert digging up a bone or a toenail. So much sports scores, so much. You have channels for food, you have channels for weather, you have channels for shopping.
Religion.
Yeah, religion. We have to remember that, you know, this machine, which has something going on 24 hours a day, all the time, always available at the flick of a switch, this machine contains everything, and whatever is on when you turn it on also constitutes television. Years ago, I had an argument with Lionel Trilling, who deplored the fact that I was writing about television for Life magazine while I was editing the New York Times Book Review. He considered it unseemly and anti-intellectual. But I could sit down and get him to admit it was hard that with the television set on in his house, he got up to 11 hours a week. He was appalled. His wife, Diana, was even more appalled. But it was true. He just didn't call it television. It was old movies that he remembered from the 30s and 40s that he cared about. It was Knicks games, which was basketball. That wasn't television. It was a moonshot or something like that. That was news. And the one program he would admit to was Kojak. He was devoted to Kojak. But it was television because it was on television, and that's what television is this great cannibal of the culture that puts everything on and regurgitates it out and is available and juxtaposed all of it. And television is old television as well as new television.
Well, exactly.
It is reruns.
Yeah, no, that's the point I want to get to next, because television is more and more becoming a museum of itself.
Yeah, well, that's the odd thing, because it becomes an archaeological museum at the same time as it's a hothouse at the same time that it's cutting edge.
You've been watching television since the late 40s, right?
Well,
early
more
50s.
Like 1951, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So a lot of the shows that are back on in syndication or in reruns in TV Land or Nick at Night, you saw them the first time around. And I'm wondering if any of these shows look really different to you now, if you're reevaluating any of them, or if your opinions are the same now as they were the first time.
Of course they're different. I was a kid. The biggest surprise for me, and you won't see it too much even on Nickelodeon, which specializes in series, reruns of series programs, but the biggest surprise is to go back to the so-called golden age of television, where usually you have to go to the Museum of Broadcasting and see all those Playhouse 90 plays and U.S. Steel Hour dramas and the rest of it that we talk about is wonderful because they had Broadway actors and they had real writers and everything. Well, it was bargain basement neo-Italian realism, kitchen sink Freud, and everybody did a lot of shouting and a lot of grunting, and it was considered authentic. And I consider it pretty dreary stuff, and not remotely to compare with the quality of both writing and of acting and of film editing we associate with programs like Hell Street Blues or China Beach or Homicide. Some wonderful things have appeared on television, and for the most part, they have expressed themselves in series programs with ensembles of quite intelligent and talented people.
My guest is TV critic John Leonard. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Leonard, TV critic for CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine. He's written a new book about TV called Smoke and Mirrors. You know what I think is an interesting change in television? When I grew up, you might watch TV or reruns of TV ironically. You might have watched Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet as ironic, but now you're told that it's ironic. It's presented in an ironic context. You don't have to figure that out for yourself.
You know how hard it is to be postmodern? It's really hard to be postmodern. If no text has more value than any other text, and there's always some superscript or subtext that only the postmodernist can figure out, and you begin by putting every single emotion and every single sort of honest, spontaneous response in quotation marks, then when you move those quotation marks around and you have reruns of the words in quotation marks, you have to have quotation marks around those or parentheses. It's why their prose is so miserable coming out of the Academy, is that you're afraid to have any kind of honest reaction because somebody will think that you're naive. And then after you've gone through that period, I mean, most people watch Melrose Place. Most of the people that I know that watch Melrose Place watch it in a heavy state of irony. But you're quite right. When it goes into reruns, and some of it has gone into reruns, well, at least Beverly Hills has gone into reruns, how are we to watch it if we watched it ironically the first time? Trying to remember what it was like to be ironic, the way we try with other programs to remember what it was like to be romantic, I think it's very hard. I think we've lost a capacity for the innocent enjoyment of entertainment, and until we find a substitute for that innocent enjoyment of entertainment, dare I suggest great art, we are stuck watching ourselves watch, which used to be Camus' definition of what an intellectual did, watching his mind. But we're not watching our minds. We're watching our emotional body temperature.
On places like at Nick at Night, TV shows are presented with the quotation marks already around the TV shows. They are presented in an ironic context.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you can still struggle back. I write in the book, I felt a little guilty because I've been a television critic, and you review books in advance, you review tape of programs before the programs are actually out. You don't see them with commercials. It's a hothouse atmosphere, and it's a little distorting. But at the time, which was 11 years ago, really, that I'd come out of the hospital and was recovering from alcoholism and various other seizures and everything, and my metabolism was entirely screwed up. I could not sleep ever. I just simply couldn't go to sleep. I started watching late at night anything that was on, because you can only read so many books and so many magazines, and you can only do so much writing, and there are these hours still stretch out before you. So I started watching this stuff, and I started watching it, I thought, as an archaeologist. Well, this was before Nick at Night, and at 3:30 in the morning, you got back-to-back reruns of Mary Tyler Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, in that stage, and I suddenly found myself both a civilian and somebody who was quite needy. At that stage, with what I needed and what I was getting, when she threw her hat in the air, I was thrilled, and I felt younger, and I felt better about myself, and I felt better about her. And I got a satisfaction that I hadn't expected, and I had to remind myself that these satisfactions, as well as some alarms, are available to everybody depending on the appetite we bring. I brought that at 3:00 in the morning because I couldn't sleep, and I got back something like a gift of grace.
Yeah, well, Mary Tyler Moore is such a good show. Anyways, what's really creepy is when you're kind of reduced to tears watching something that you know is drag, but you're just very emotionally vulnerable at the moment.
Well, we have to take our emotions where we can get them, right?
So how does drinking look to you on television? There's so many series in which a character drinks and where that character may or may not realize they have a problem.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it used to be. Oddly enough, one of the first people who was so sensitive to this was Stephen Bochco. And very early on in Hill Street Blues, you had one of the cops who clearly had a drinking problem and was out of control, and everybody was worried about him. And when he finally got to an AA meeting, there was Farrillo, his boss, the captain, already at the AA meeting. And then you look, and in every show that Bochco has done since, except the situation comedy shows, the problems of alcoholism have come up, and the glamorizing of the drinking has disappeared. It's just not there. The same is true of Cagney and Lacey. I mean, that was scary in the last year, 2 years of that show on the air. As Cagney clearly had a drinking problem, as her father had died of alcoholism, they took her all the way through denial in every stage of it until she went into AA, and then they showed her at AA meetings, which was extraordinary. I mean, it's the opposite of Murphy Brown, where, sure, she drank and she stopped and it never came up again. I don't think the drinking is glamorized as much as it used to be. I think still in situation comedies, it's an excuse for an easy joke. It's still a temptation in all comedy, or even in some drama, to let an actor do a drunk scene to prove certain skills. I'm not to be trusted on some of that because I bring my own baggage to it. I look at it; it makes me uncomfortable. I don't need to see it. I don't want to. I don't want to go to a movie like Francis anymore. I didn't even, as I again say in the book, but that's again a private response, absolutely personal. I'm one of those people who did not watch Cheers, even though I knew it was a quite good program, but I did not watch it regularly because I simply didn't want to be in a bar. I'd spent 20 years of my life in a bar. I didn't need to be in a bar. even with the good jokes. But that's personal. My impression is that just as only bad girls smoke on television anymore, there's very little glamorizing of the drinking. When Andy Sipowicz does it on NYPD Blue, we know he's in trouble and he's violent and his life is falling apart. And we're meant to know that, and we feel it.
You know, in writing about whether violence on TV actually causes violence in real life, mm-hmm. you mentioned that Beavis and Butthead episode in which, you know, a kid had set fire to the house.
Mm-hmm.
And a Beavis and Butthead episode was accused of inspiring or teaching the kid how to do this. And you point out that when you were five, you burned down the bedroom in your house.
Well, you probably knew some kids, too, who played with matches.
Well, I was wondering how you managed to do it.
Well, I was just playing with matches, and I was trying to see if the bedspread would catch on fire. Well, it did, and then the curtains did, and then everything else. And the fire department came in the middle of the afternoon, and I asked them, "Do you have to tell my mother?" And they said, "Yeah, kid, I have to tell her when she gets back from work." But, you know, my point about the Beavis and Butthead as well was that kid who set his trailer on fire, that trailer was not even wired for cable. So he had to go somewhere else in the neighborhood in order to watch Beavis and Butthead. And then you begin to ask the question, these are stupid questions, which should occur to anybody, that the kid who was wired for cable, who presumably had better access more often on demand to Beavis and Butthead, why he hadn't burned down his house, why the other kid did. Well, there might be something in that kid, and there might be something in that kid's family life. It's like I now go to the ridiculous extent when you hear about a new mass murderer, whether they've shot up the Long Island Railroad or whether they've shot somebody in front of NBC, you wait for the information, which you'll find in the third day of reporting, as to whether that person watched television or whether he'd gone to a movie that might have inspired him. And when there's no evidence of television, you say, gee, Jeffrey Dahmer didn't watch television, so I guess we can't blame that on television.
If I might just digress for a moment, I can't help but wonder what went through your mind when you watched your bedroom go up in flames?
Well, I was 5 years old, and I said, "Uh-oh." No, what do you do when you're a kid and you know things that you've obviously been told not to do? Don't play with matches. I must have been told that. You are experimenting. That's what kids do. They take apart clocks to they want to put them back together. They just don't know how. Well, it gets out of hand. There are forces larger than you in the world, and you say, "Oh Jesus, I'm in trouble." But it was no more profound than that. It was not, I don't want to exaggerate this, I was not surrounded by a flaming inferno. A bedspread was on fire, and then a couple of curtains were on fire, and then I shouted for the woman who was babysitting at the time. I mean, I came running, crying out, and she felt that she couldn't handle it, so she got a couple of fire engines. I had no profound thoughts except, I'm in trouble.
And how deep trouble were you in? What did your mother do?
Well, you know, my mother was one of that earlier generation of single mothers who had to work in order that my brother and I could eat. So when we got into trouble, she tended to blame herself. It was that guilt of not having been there that she would blame. So I was not beaten. I was not sent to a therapist. It was assumed that this was mischief that wouldn't have occurred if there'd been a more attentive parent around. I'm sorry about that, but that's how she took it. You know, I probably deserved to have my hand burned or something like that, although I would, of course, not do that.
Did you manipulate that guilt that she was feeling?
Oh, yeah, of course. Kids are very smart at that, very smart. But I look back, and actually, my childhood was altogether satisfactory. I enjoyed being a latchkey child because it required me to develop some independent resources.
Your new book opens with a quote from Andy Warhol, and the quote is, "When I got my first television set, I stopped caring so much about personal relationships." Does that quote have any personal resonance for you?
None. I just loved the quote. I thought it was very funny. I thought that it would signal, if anything possibly could, that this book wasn't going to be entirely humorless. It wasn't going to be entirely sociological, anthropological, alarmist, or more deep think, and it was going to be it was going to at least mention that aspect of TV that is a circus and a wishing well, and a substitute for things that are missing. So that was all. It was to ingratiate the book at the very beginning.
Well, John Leonard, good to talk with you again, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
John Leonard's new book is called Smoke and Mirrors, Violence, Television, and Other American Cultures. Coming up, the J.D. Salinger story that's about to be published in book form. This is Fresh Air. The publishing world is abuzz with the news that a small press will bring out in book form J.D. Salinger's last known writing, a short story that appeared in The New Yorker on June 19, 1965. The book's exact pub date is a mystery, like so many other things connected with Salinger, so book critic Maureen Corrigan got impatient and read Salinger's story in its original New Yorker incarnation. Here are her impressions.
No other character in literature breaks a reader's heart as quickly as J.D. Salinger's Seymour Glass. Within the space of 15 pages in the 1948 short story, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, the 31-year-old Seymour is introduced to us, wins our love, and then blows his brains out in a Miami Beach hotel room. Cynically speaking, Seymour's suicide was a stroke of genius on Salinger's part. Every time a reader finishes that story, she or he becomes transformed from a fan to a mourner, someone primed to hear anecdotes about the deceased. And that's what Salinger served up in the books that followed Banana Fish throughout the 1950s. Franny and Zooey, Raise High the Roof Beam Carpenters, and Seymour, An Introduction, flesh out our sense of the extraordinary Glass siblings. Brilliant, fast-talking New Yorkers, distinguished like Holden Caulfield by their loathing of phonies and by their obsessive talk about Seymour. He's the absent center of the family. That's why the news that the last known Glass family story had been exhumed from a 1965 issue of The New Yorker and would be published on its own this spring was so thrilling. Many of us late baby boomer Salinger fans weren't even aware that there was another Glass family tale, and the advance word was that Hapworth 16, 1924, as this novella-length story is entitled, was told in the form of a letter written by a 7-year-old Seymour from summer camp. At last, some words straight from Seymour's mouth. Or are they? Seymour's writer brother Buddy may be at work again here. Buddy was the brother closest to Seymour, and he's the narrator of all the other tales that explicitly deal with Seymour, including Banana Fish. He introduces Hapworth by telling us, twice, that he's faithfully transcribing an exact copy of Seymour's juvenile letter. Methinks he doth protest too much. Hapworth reads like an act of exorcism on Buddy's part— an unsubtle, sometimes vicious attempt to quell a spirit that he loves far too much for his own good. The pint-sized Seymour we meet in the opening paragraphs of Hapworth is a smug, creepily erudite version of the Seymour of other memories. In fact, he sounds a lot like one of those extraterrestrial children from the sci-fi classic Village of the Damned. Referring, for instance, to his fellow campers, he coldly opines that few of these magnificent, healthy, sometimes remarkably handsome boys will mature. the majority will merely senesce. But while Seymour may be dismissive of his campmates, he's a quite avid observer of the adult women at the camp. He compares the saucy bosoms displayed by the camp owner's wife to his mother's and speculates on the condition of the camp nurse's maidenhead. This is the first time that bodily lusts have intruded themselves into the Glass saga. Indeed, scholars often peg Seymour as a Christ figure, and I think Salinger may be tweaking them here by presenting Seymour's godlike qualities in absurdly broad form. Seymour foresees his own death and refers to earlier earthly appearances. I have to confess, my attention began to wander to the New Yorker ads circa 1965 on my Xeroxed copy of Hapworth long before the story ended. One of those ads was for a new comedy record by Woody Allen, which got me thinking that Hapworth reminds me a bit of Allen's Stardust Memories, the movie in which he ridicules his fans and critics. Here, by sarcastically undermining and exaggerating Seymour's trademark saintliness, Salinger spoofs his critics' responses at the expense of his beloved creation. Hapworth makes Seymour, who's a magical creature, the Glass family unicorn, into a cartoon. It's a story, finally, that will only interest scholars, the audience Salinger hates. In Seymour, An Introduction, the last book Salinger published before Hapworth, Buddy quotes a letter from Seymour in which Seymour says the two questions Buddy, as a writer, will get asked by God when he dies are, "Were most of your stars out? Were you busy writing your heart out?" Hapworth might earn Salinger a few years in purgatory. Otherwise, I think his salvation is assured.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Prudick, Richard Parker, Al Banks, Dan Lachlan, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.